Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 68, Quantum Resource Theories with Gilad Gwer. Gilad is a professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Calgary and also a member of the Institute for Quantum Science and Technology there. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/68. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers. And now, Gilad Gwer. Hey, Gilad, how you doing?
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Now, I brought you here to talk about quantum resource theories. You've done a lot of work on quantum resource theories, and there's something that I really haven't seen very much of, but they seem to be very useful. I've seen a lot of really big names that I know from other things working with them as well. I'd really like to see how these things interact with physics especially, but you know, it's interesting that they have a lot more applications than just that. So what I'd really like to start with is, you know, just ask you to talk a little bit about resource theories in general, and maybe what are the problems you're trying to solve in particular?
Yes. Let me start by actually talk about the story of unification of forces of nature, because this will be easier to connect resource theories with this idea of unification. If you think about already in the 17th century, when we heard about Newton, right, and he discovered that gravity, the gravitational force, there was actually this discovery was really a discovery of unification. There were two forces that people at the time didn't realize are the same. One is the force on Earth that pushing things down, right? Everything is pushed to the ground. And then there was the force, gravitational force between planetary objects. And that was quite a big discovery at the time. And this was quite remarkable, this kind of unification, when we have two different things, different forces, and we see that they actually correspond to the same thing. Another thing, it took 2 centuries later with Maxwell, which was in the 19th century, where he basically unified magnetism and electricity, bringing them together, realizing that it's really the same electromagnetic potential that corresponds to both of these forces. This had a huge implications. And even in the 20th century, we had something like that, the unification of the electromagnetic force with the weak force. And for this, this was discovered by Glasow, Salam, and Weinberg, who got actually a Nobel Prize for that. So unification of forces is a very big thing. And maybe I'll just say one more thing about it, that even today, people working on grind unified theory, trying to unify the gravitational force with all these other forces, this is a bit more challenging, one of the biggest open problem in the field of physics. Physics in the 21st century and also in the 20th century is the unification of quantum and gravity together, and we are still unable to do it. Now, quantum resource theories have something very similar to this idea of unification. It's really a big framework that captures a lot of concepts in one mathematical structure. So to try to explain how it is, let me say a few words about quantum resource theories kind of in general. Or maybe let me start with entanglement theory, with the beginning where we start where quantum information theory started its development. So quantum information started in the early 90s, and people thought about entanglement many, many years before that. Einstein and Bell and everyone spoke about entanglement. But it was only in the 90s that people realized that entanglement is not just interesting from a fundamental point of view, but rather it is a resource that we can do stuff with it. We can, for example, do something known as quantum teleportation. We can use entanglement to teleport in quantum information from one location to another one without actual communication, just with entanglement. So this is possible because entanglement is a resource. Of course, entanglement has many other applications. We can use it in something known as super dense coding, where we do some coding and encode two classical bits with one qubit with the spin of the electron that has two options only, up and down, even though it has two options, somehow, if I have entanglement, I can encode in that zero and one with the up and down of the electron. I can encode actually four possibilities, two classical bits. Two classical bits corresponds to four possibilities. So this is quite remarkable that we can use entanglement to do things. And of course, today we use it also for quantum cryptography, for quantum computing. There's a lot of applications for entanglement. And if you look even at the number of papers that even have been published just on entanglement, you can see there's almost no publication on entanglement until the 90s. Just a few papers that talk mostly with Bell non-locality, which maybe I'll talk a bit later. It's actually different than entanglement, although it's related to it. And only in the 90s, you can see thousands of papers suddenly coming up on entanglement because we discover it as a resource and it's very, very useful. So this idea that this kind of revolution of our understanding about familiar topics such as entanglement is really what's very prominent in resource theories. You always take something that we actually know and you suddenly realize that you can look at it completely different and use that different outlook to apply it to certain problems in physics. So let's look at a few other examples and how all of this related to the unification I was talking before. Maybe first of all, I'll tell that today we have lots of resource theories. There are resource theories of entanglement, like I mentioned, but it's also of asymmetry in physics, systems that are not out of symmetry. There are resource theories about quantum Shannon theory. It's a resource theory for communication. It's the information, the quantum version of information theory. That itself can be viewed as a resource theory. Non-Gaussianity, quantum memory, quantum thermodynamics, Bell non-locality, quantum computing, magic there, non-Markovianity, incompatibility of quantum measurements, several topics in foundation of physics, all been used and can be understood in the context of quantum resource theories. So it's quite, quantum resource theory really touches a lot of different areas of physics. But what makes it so powerful is its unification power. So let me explain what I mean by that. Let's look at entanglement theory. There in entanglement theory, there is this quantity known, it's called entropy of entanglement. It's basically measure how much entanglement a pair of quantum objects share. These objects can be spins of an electron, atoms, molecules, anything. But systems can be entangled quantumly. And there is a way to measure how much they are entangled. And one of the figure of merit or of the really the natural quantity that appears like the best way to quantify it is somehow to say, maybe it's not the only measure, but it's one of the main measures to quantify entanglement known as an entropy of entanglement. And it's a very big quantity in entanglement theory. Now you have another quantity called the free energy in thermodynamics. Seems like a very different quantity, totally not related to the entropy of entanglement that is discussed in entanglement theory. Then you have quantum Shannon theory. There are people talking about capacities of quantum channel to transmit information. Seems yet another very different quantities. In fact, all of these quantities in the light of resource theories have been recognized as all being related to a quantity known as the relative entropy of a resource. So the relative entropy of a resource in entanglement theory reduces to entropy of entanglement. In thermodynamic, it reduces to the free energy of the system. And in quantum Shannon theory, it reduces to the various channel capacities in different scenarios. So that's the beauty of quantum resource theory. They really unify those three totally different theories in physics. One deals with communication between parties, one deals with thermodynamics, and one deals with entanglement. And all of those three different examples that I gave here, and many more, all can be treated in a much more general setting. And we can see that a lot of the properties are not unique to the specific resource theories, but they're coming from something much more fundamental and general. So this is kind of like my introduction of resource theories. And there are a lot of questions we still don't know, and it's really started to blooming in the last 10 years, I would say, where people recognized that even quantum information theory can be viewed as a theory of interconversion among different resources. Now, I will just say one more thing, why quantum information theory is so closely related to resource theories is because quantum information deals with resources that can be either classical or quantum, dynamic or static, like a quantum channel is a dynamical resource, static resources like entanglement, and it can be noisy or noiseless. So it really leads to a plethora of quantum information processing tasks, this kind of diversity of different types of resources. And one can convert one resource to another, just like we do in chemistry. In fact, there is a notion, for example, in chemistry of catalysis that actually also exists in entanglement theory. There is something known as entanglement catalysis, or even in thermodynamics, where we're looking at cyclic processes where the system, the environment kind of remain in the same state and act as a catalyst to enable certain transformations. So all of those theories are all related and can be very nicely put together as a single resource theory in some sense that reduces to each one of them like a tree, like different branches, and reduces to those. Once you put this specific structure, the theory reduces to each one of them separately. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. One question I might start off with that then is, what are the resources giving you? So you have a resource, said entanglement could be a resource. At some point, at least you're going to say it, this athermality is going to be a resource.
Right.
It's a resource, but it's a resource for what? What yes. can you do with the resources?
Yes. So like I mentioned, with entanglement, the simplest example to say is quantum teleportation, where you can actually, you know, sometimes distant parties are located far from each other. And if I want to communicate quantum information, meaning suppose I want to submit some information that is encoded in a quantum particle, if I want to transmit the quantum particle from location A to location B, due to decoherence of the environment, the system will decohere, will interact with the environment, and it's very difficult to actually transmit quantum information from one location to the other. One way to combat this difficulty is if you have the resource of entanglement, because if you are able to generate entanglement between Alice and Bob, between these two locations, A and B, then you don't need to transmit particles. You can simply use that resource to simulate basically a noiseless quantum channel, a channel that transmits information from system A to B without actually transmitting anything. It's only the entanglement, because the two systems are entangled, somehow if I do something on system A, it affects what's happening on system B. And I only need to communicate classical information. That I consider relatively easy, because we have developed over the years very good systems to communicate classical information. And that part of communication I consider as free, as easy. And then the resource really circumvent certain restriction. What is the restriction? To be local, right? So we are far from each other. We have a certain restriction. We cannot do global operation on a joint system. If the two systems are far from each other, I cannot do certain operations that are joint on both of them, for example, or communicate, like a communication. I cannot communicate from one to the other. Entanglement enable us to do that. We can overcome that limitation. Similarly, with if I look at quantum Shannon theory, also related to entanglement, is another very interesting application is, you know, if you have a channel, like a system that transmit information, transmit quantum particle from one place to another, it's typically noisy, but it's not totally, it's not destroying all information. You can still transmit some information through it. And so if you have two of the same channel, you would expect the capacity to transmit information to increase by two. Right? That's very natural. The beauty of quantum resource theory is that it uses this non-intuitive phenomena into those kind of problems. So what happens, for example, the capacity can increase more than two, just because I'm allowing entanglement somehow between the two channels. And so if I have two channels, this was a discovery that has been found in 2008, not too long ago, that if you take two channels, they can be used to transmit more than twice each capacity alone. So the two are bigger than the sum of the two. So that's the kind of beauty of how quantum non-intuitive phenomena kind of penetrate into everything that we do. And it's always, you have these non-intuitive properties that always can surprise you, and you realize it's not what you may originally thought. So yeah.
Now, another thing is, as a resource, I guess you're using up the resource as you do these things. Is that correct?
Right. Yes. So what we do with resource theory, we learn the most efficient way to convert one resource to another. And in that conversion, of course, the original resource has been consumed. So even in quantum teleportation that I mentioned, what we do really in quantum teleportation is converting a static quantum resource known as entanglement. It's static because it just can stay like that. If there is no interaction with environment that destroys the entanglement, then the entanglement will stay like that forever, right? So if we were in an ideal situation, this resource will remain intact. And it's always saying it's static, but it's also quantum resource. And then what we convert it to another type of resource, it's also a quantum resource because it's a quantum channel. We basically created a quantum channel, which is a dynamic resource. So we converted a static resource, static quantum resource, to a quantum dynamical resource. And the resource is consumed. Now, we can talk about thermodynamics, for example. There we have also similar situations where what we do is we take a system like the free energy and we extract it into work, into thermodynamical work. You have pistols and you have different things. You can literally extract work. And the reason you are able to really extract work, if we think about it a bit more deeply, is because you have a system that is outside equilibrium with the surrounding. And once the system is away from equilibrium, from the surrounding, I can use it as a resource. Resource theories tells us what is the best way to use, the most efficient way to use the resource without any waste, with some ingenuity, some very nice ideas to manipulate the resource. So there are sometimes, if you use a catalyst, for example, it's not only that I'm not going to waste the resource, but actually having the catalyst enable me to do even more things with the resource. So there are different methods that helps us use the resource in the best possible way, both not wasting it, but also finding ideas and tricks to use it in the best possible way. So yeah, that's what we do in resource theories. And we develop those techniques, those systems, and we develop it both in the general sense. So there is two types of work on resource theories. One is more focusing on the general structure of resource theories. Even some mathematicians taking it further and using some high-level mathematics to describe these concepts, including category theory, talking about symmetric monoidal categories and so on. But we are focusing in physics more on the application side, but still looking at the specific applications to specific problems in physics. And there are a lot of applications. So once we calculated, say, found general results in resource theory, I can apply it studying a lot of problems in physics, like in thermodynamics, Shannon theory, entanglement theory, quantum computing, foundations of quantum mechanics, and so on.
All right. So the paper that I saw that I found so interesting was on the role of quantum coherence in thermodynamics. Because obviously, as soon as I see the title, I want to know the answer. That's an interesting question. But we have to sort of get an idea about, what quantum coherence is and how it relates to thermodynamics. And I'm not completely sure where the best place to start is, but I think maybe we might want to talk a little bit about the density matrix that sort of goes through the entire paper is
right.
What the density matrix has to look like for different sorts of situations, really, is what I see in the paper. But it's kind of important to get an idea about what the density matrix is and basically what the different elements mean. So that's what I meant when I emailed you. I might want to talk about a map of the density matrix because different elements have different sorts of meanings. So I'd like to have some idea about that. I also assume we're going to have to talk about most of the things that you're talking about with the density matrix. The map is coming about in sort of the energy eigenbasis as well. Right. So that's sort of where I'd like to go. So do you think you can talk a little bit about that density matrix and how it relates to statistical mechanics into the resource series?
Yes, for sure. In the resource theory of thermodynamics, we have systems that are, we think typically about, at least historically, about large system. Right? So we don't talk about small system like quantum typically, but usually you think about large system and with lots of particles and you describe them system. We say that some system are in thermal equilibrium and they are described by something known as the Gibbs state. That's how we characterize them. And there is both end of that in the quantum world that is described with a density matrix for the Gibbs state. Now, what is a density matrix? If we're looking at the first axiom of quantum mechanics, that for any physical system, there is a corresponding Hilbert space. And there is in that Hilbert space, all the information about the physical system is contained in an element of that Hilbert space, which is a vector, a unit vector in that Hilbert space. Now, and those are called typically pure states because we're talking about closed physical system. But when we talk about open physical system, it could be correlations between the system and the environment. And so von Neumann came up in the 30s, 1930s, with this formalism of the density matrix, which basically capture all the information that contained about the physical system that is also maybe interacting with the environment. So if I have a system that is not isolated, I can still describe it with a density matrix and it's a well defined. So either it's correlated with the environment classically or quantumly, it doesn't matter. I can still describe it with a density matrix and it contains all the information about the system. And there is a formalism that tells us how we can extract information about the system from this density matrix. It's essentially the formalism of quantum mechanics modified slightly to incorporate this possible interaction with the environment. And so you have to make some discorrelation with a reference system like the environment or whatever it is. It doesn't have to be the full environment. It could be just another system that it's correlated with. You're still going to describe the local system by a density matrix. It's like we say in physics many times, tracing out all the other degrees of freedom, all the other properties, like I cannot, for example, know everything about the environment, right? The environment typically contains lots of particles and we have no knowledge about them much. So we have to trace out those degrees of freedom. And as a result, there is an additional uncertainty what this our actual system is, but there is still some knowledge about our system. So it's all described with the density matrix. The density matrix really kind of capture it, contain both the information about the system that is accessible, but also tells you there are some things you cannot know because you don't know everything about the environment. And so there is a certain uncertainty about that. There is also an uncertainty inherent in quantum physics, which is also even in pure state that has to do with the indeterministic nature of quantum mechanics. That's a different types of uncertainty involved, not the one captured by the density matrix so much. It's even exist in the pure state case in the of the description of quantum mechanics. Now, density matrices, that's how we describe the system, physical system. But now physical systems evolve. Now, we know that they are evolved in quantum mechanics according to Schrödinger equation. But again, when we have open physical systems, we can ask what is the most general evolution of this density matrix, because once we have open physical system, then the pure state is no longer pure. The system is described by a mixed density matrix or mixed state. That's how we call a density matrix. But also the evolution is no longer described by the simple Schrödinger equation, but rather by something that incorporates density matrices and incorporate also the interaction with the environment and the tracing out of the environment, because we have no knowledge what the environment is. As a result of that, there is an evolution of that density matrix to another density matrix. And this is called the quantum channel, the most general evolution of a density matrix. You see, density matrices can be pure. They can contain the pure case of isolated system, but they are more general. In the same way, quantum channels can contain the Schrödinger equation in some sense, contain the unitary evolution, but they don't have to be unitary. They can be not unitary. And the reason they are not unitary, again, is because we're talking about an effective description of the system, because the system is correlated with the environment. The whole system plus environment evolve unitarily according to the Schrödinger equation. But once we're tracing out the environment, because we don't have access to it, we get an effective description that the system evolving not unitarily. So it's not really the ontology is unitarily evolution, but effectively, it is non-unitary evolution because we don't have access to the environment. And therefore, even though the state of the system plus environment is pure and evolved unitarily, the system alone is mixed and evolved not unitarily. So that's how it evolves. So now, if I'm looking at the Gibbs state, and going back to thermodynamics, so that's just general formalism about quantum mechanics. And this is also fit very well with statistical mechanics and everything, because in statistical mechanics, we're also considering many particles, many systems, looking at the bulk properties of physical systems. And the density matrix plays a very natural role when we do those descriptions. And for example, the Gibbs state is an example of a physical system that described by a Gibbs state, it means it's in thermal equilibrium. And the Gibbs state is closely related to the Hamiltonian of the system. It's defined if I go mathematically one step further, it's really defined as the exponent in some sense of the Hamiltonian. So it's uniquely determined by the Hamiltonian. And therefore, it is commuting also with the Hamiltonian, which means that it can be written in its spectral decomposition. Every Hermitian operator can be diagonalized, and its eigenvectors are the energy eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. And so if we fix a basis mathematically and we're taking the basis in which the Hamiltonian is diagonal, then the Gibbs state is diagonal as well. Now, it turns out that any other system that is not the Gibbs state is not in thermal equilibrium with its surrounding. It means that system, we say it has athermality. It's not thermal because it's athermal. It's not in equilibrium, which means that you can use it in one way or another to extract work. So systems that are away from thermal equilibrium, right, they are evolving. You know, if I just take a cup of tea and just wait, of course, the cup of tea will reach eventually to a thermal equilibrium with its environment. But that's when I talk about cup of tea, the same process happens even if I'll talk about a quantum particle and throw it into a thermal bath and ask what will happen. Originally, this quantum system is much smaller than cup of tea. It contains much less degrees of freedom, much less particles, but it still has its own Hamiltonian that I can define, and therefore I can define its own Gibbs state. And if it's not in its Gibbs state, eventually it will evolve to a Gibbs state, and I can use it to extract work even with this quantum particle. So what's special about quantum particle versus a cup of tea? I would just say that when we talk about small particles, there is this phenomena of coherence, quantum coherence, that comes into the picture. Because typically when we talk about large physical systems, there is a process known as decoherence, where effectively the environment makes everything diagonal, destroy the coherence among energy eigenstates. And because of that, the system, when we treat classical systems, we're only dealing with systems that are diagonal. They are in the same basis. So the Gibbs state is diagonal, we say. Its eigenvectors are the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. But also all the other systems are diagonal as well, because they are interacting with the environment, and very quickly they, even if they are not initially diagonal, they very quickly become diagonal. Very, very quickly relative to some time scale that is relevant to the system. But it happened very quickly, and there is no really any way to utilize this coherence. And so if we reduce the size of the system and talk about a small system, then there is a coherence is more significant. And then the question becomes what this coherence can do. Does it have more power? Can it do more? And what are really the resources of quantum thermodynamics exactly are? I can say a few more words about that if you want me to go in this direction.
That would be interesting. That was a lot, right? So I guess so the first thing I want to make sure is, so the interpretation of the diagonal density matrix is that it's an equilibrium system, is that?
So there are two things about it. So there are two kind of like resources. So one is when I look at the density matrix, if it is diagonal, it doesn't have coherence, but it still has something that we sometimes call informational non-equilibrium. So what it means, it's like non-uniformity. It's like very different than, it could be very different than the Gibbs state, because the Gibbs state is diagonal, but it's specific. It has specific values on its diagonal. In systems that are diagonal and are not, they can still not be in thermal equilibrium. Those are the classical systems. So the classical systems are precisely those that are diagonal. In quantum physics, diagonal density matrices represent classical systems. So that's what we capture, just this is like we sometimes call it in thermodynamics quasi-classical, because we only care about the energy eigenbasis, and there could be degeneracy between energy levels. So every energy level may have several states of the system that corresponds to the exact same energy level. And those states can have coherence, but we don't care about that kind of coherence in thermodynamics. We only care about the coherence between energy levels. That's where the things happen. That's why we call it quasi-classical and not totally classical, because there could still in principle be quantum effects within the energy level. But if we ignore that for a moment, so this is really classical. Or if there is no degeneracy to the Hamiltonian, then it's totally classical. So if it's diagonal in the energy eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, then the system is classical. And the whole formalism of quantum mechanics reduces to the classical formalism of statistical mechanics. Everything would follow the same. The difference comes when we have this off-diagonal terms. Then that's not classical. That's a quantum effect that represents coherence. I hope that answers your question.
So in your paper, I think you talked about this sort of non-Gibbs state in the diagonal as asymmetry. Is that correct?
Yes. So let me say maybe a few resources in okay. thermodynamics that I'll clarify them. One of them is the resource, I like to call it the resource theory of non-uniformity. One of them is the resource that we just discussed. Suppose everything is classical. So then what is the resource in thermodynamics? Again, it's systems outside of thermal equilibrium. Now, in thermal equilibrium, we describe in quantum mechanics, classical system described with diagonal density matrices. So the Gibbs state is diagonal, and the system, its state, the state of the system is also diagonal, but not equal to the Gibbs state. And that's why it can be a resource. That's why I can use it to extract thermodynamical work. That's how I put the classical thermodynamics in quantum notations, right? So I'll put it as a diagonal density matrices. That's how I will translate it from the classical probability distribution into density matrices. Now, the diagonal ones, where the diagonal is like a probability distribution. Now, it turns out that in the this classical case, there is a remarkable property that it turns out that you can always simulate any physical system with a trivial Hamiltonian. What does that mean? It is always possible to describe the resource from a resource perspective. So every resource in thermodynamics has a Hamiltonian associated with it. So I cannot just say a physical system. I have to specify what its Hamiltonian. So the physical system goes along with its Hamiltonian. And it turns out that this Hamiltonian has a corresponding Gibbs state. So I can describe any thermodynamical system with a pair of states. One is the state of the system, the probability distribution of its states, or in quantum mechanics is the density matrix describing it. And the other one is the Gibbs state that corresponds to Hamiltonian. It's almost, we can talk about it interchangeably, because if you know the Gibbs state, you know the Hamiltonian and vice versa. So I can think about it as two density matrices, one of the system and one that corresponds to the Hamiltonian, the Gibbs state. And the more different they are from each other, the more resourceful it is, the more work you can extract from it. And it turns out that any system like that, there exists another resource with a zero Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian literally zero, so its Gibbs state is uniform, is all the probability are equal, are the same. The probability distribution is totally uniform. So in quantum mechanics, we call it maximally mixed state. That's how the Gibbs state of it. You can also understand it physically as a system with very, very high temperature. So when they are very, very high temperature, the Gibbs state is totally maximally mixed, because everything is totally mixed, right? If the temperature is so high, the equilibrium state is the one that is totally mixed. The more the temperature goes down and you are becoming very, very close to cold temperature, more quantum effects come in, right? It's more pure. It has more purity, it has more coherence, and so on. But it turns out in the classical case, if you have any physical system, you can always find another resource, another physical system with another Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian can be the zero Hamiltonian. It will have the same power as this resource. The resources are equivalent. So you can always simulate it from a resource perspective simply by a maximally mixed state, as that's the Gibbs state, but then the other state, the state of the system, can be pure. And that's like the resource theory of non-uniformity. The more you are non-uniform, the more resourceful the system is. And you can always essentially simulate any classical thermodynamical system with a trivial Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian zero Hamiltonian. You can always, from a resource theory perspective, they become equivalent. They are equivalent resources. So I don't need to treat, in the classical case, I can basically work with zero Hamiltonian, which simplify a lot of calculations. If you have Hamiltonian that is zero, everything becomes much simpler to handle. So that's why I call that resource. But the reason I went into all of this is just to say that when the systems are classical, the resource is really non-uniformity. How non-uniform it is when I map it to the trivial Hamiltonian. Sometimes I like to call it the church of the trivialized Hamiltonian. Because you can, for any system, any thermodynamical system, you can find another system with a zero Hamiltonian that mimics all the properties, that everything, any amount of work that you can extract from your original system, you can extract from this other system. And so it really shows that the resource itself is really non-uniformity, how non-uniform the distribution is. The other type of resource is the off-diagonal terms, which are the coherence, how much coherence we have. Now, it is a big open question in the field if there is even a third type of a resource that goes beyond that, and we don't know. And the reason there could be another resource, because it's not clear that even these off-diagonal terms, we don't know a lot about them, how they work out. They make things extremely complicated mathematically, and therefore there is a lot of open questions in the field. But we did some progress. And this is the time translation invariant property that talks about this coherence. If the state is not time translation invariant, is not diagonal in the energy basis, which is, that's equivalent to say that, then it has coherence, then it has a resource, additional things that we can do with it that we couldn't have done if we didn't have those off diagonal terms. And so we're trying to really harness these quantum effects to thermodynamics to do more things that we couldn't do classically.
One thing about the Gibbs state. So the Gibbs state is a generalization of something like a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, or is it a generalization of all three of the big distributions you see in a statistical mechanics class?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
So depending on the Hamiltonian, you could end up with the Fermi-Dirac distribution, or you could end up with the Bose-Einstein distribution. It all depends on what that Hamiltonian
is. The physical system changes,
Excellent. So that's pretty good. So, I mean, I would like to go on and actually get to the role of quantum coherence in thermodynamics. I don't know, how would you like to proceed? I think we've already talked about athermality, right?
Yeah, we spoke about athermality, which comprise of two things. In the classical athermality, comprise of non-uniformity. That's what I said, because everything is equivalent to a zero Hamiltonian. And so the Gibbs state become maximally mixed state. And then if the system is far from being maximally mixed, i.e., it's not uniform, then it's a resource. It's more resourceful. So the more non-uniformity we have, the more resourceful the system is. And in the quantum case, we also have this off-diagonal, so we have also coherence. So athermality comprised of two resources. It's really the theory of quantum thermodynamics is really a theory of asymmetry or time translation asymmetry, which corresponds to coherence, and non-uniformity, which corresponds to the informational non-equilibrium. It's the information side. One is information consideration and one is energy considerations. And when they are both combined together, they bring you thermodynamics in the quantum case. That's what it is. In the classical case, it's essentially only information consideration is sufficient, turns out, because you can always bring the Hamiltonian to be zero. And then you don't have the time translation, doesn't play any role because the Hamiltonian is zero. So there is no energy eigenstates and stuff like that. It's all zero.
Is this where the partial ordering sort of comes in? I have been fascinated with partial orders since, you know, I picked up the Lattice Theory book the library was getting rid of for 50 cents. And, you know, I was sitting there reading it, you know, with second PBS station on, and I'm reading about partial orders. I thought partial orders were just an extremely useful idea to think about things.
Definitely.
Is it with the resources or the channels? Where does the partial order come in all of this?
In fact, it comes in all over the place.
Oh, okay.
So it's both with channels and with states. The partial order in resource theory comes because it's a general concept of resource theory. This goes back to the general structure of resource theory. So you see, there are certain properties, so for example, in thermodynamics, Gibbs state, right? That's unique to thermodynamics. It's not in entanglement theory. It's not appearing in quantum Shannon theory. It's in thermodynamics because it's natural, specific to the problem. But partial order occurs in all of those theories. What does it really mean? So in resource theories, we divide, let's start with states. We divide the sets of all density matrices into two types. Those that we call free. What is free? Free means I can generate it for free under some restriction. So there is always some restriction imposed. For example, in entanglement theory, the restriction is that the parties are located locally, and they are far from each other. So all you can do is local operations, and those local operations can be quantum even, but you cannot do global operations. Like if you have two electrons close to each other, if they're close to each other, maybe you can do some joint operation on both of them simultaneously. But this you cannot do if they are far from each other. So this separation imposes a constraint that you can only do local operations on system A and system B, but you can also communicate classical information. This is known in the field as local operations and classical communication, or in short, LOCC. Those are the free operations. This is what you can do to your system. So with those free operations, I can prepare density matrices because, for example, Alice can prepare some spin, some system on her lab. Bob can prepare some system on his lab. The way you're going to describe it by a tensor product of two systems. Entanglement is something that you cannot describe as a tensor product because you cannot prepare it by LOCC. In fact, resource theories provide the precise definition of entanglement because you can define entanglement as a property of a physical system that cannot be generated or nor increased by LOCC, by local operations assisted with classical communication, because classical communication cannot generate entanglement, and nor local operations. So anything else is entanglement, anything that you cannot prepare like that. And once you separated those two things, then there is the question become among those resources, those that are not free, states that are not tensor product, for example, in entanglement theory, or in thermodynamic states that are not the Gibbs states, I can impose an ordering between states, between resources. Some resources are more resourceful than others, right? So how do I define this partial order? I say that a resource A is bigger than resource B if by free operations I can convert resource A to resource B. So if I'm given resource A, I can create resource B. That means resource B is less resourceful, because if I only have resource B, I cannot generate resource A. But if I have resource A and I'm allowing the free operation are there, I can use those free operations to generate resource B. For example, in entanglement theory, in teleportation, you only allowed to do LOCC. So this is how we were able to convert one resource, the entanglement, to another type of resource, which was a quantum channel. That was resource B. That was the conversion. So a pair of entangled state is as resourceful in entanglement theory as one use of a quantum channel. And this kind of ordering between different types of resources is a partial order and not a total order. You see, and that also comes to thermodynamics, because in thermodynamics, we have the second law of thermodynamics that people always think about it as a total order. That if a system, you know, has more entropy, right, I can only increase entropy and there is a clear direction of where it goes. But in fact, it is not a total order, especially if we're not reducing a bit the size of the system, going away from the thermodynamical limit and looking at quantum systems. There are many entropies, some of them known as the Rainy entropies, that kick in. They all non-increasing under certain thermodynamical processes, cyclic thermodynamical processes. And what you can see is that it's really a partial order that what you have here, that sometimes resources A and B cannot be compared. They are just two resources that none of them is bigger than the other, but they are not even equivalent. So it means they sometimes for certain tasks, resource A is more useful. For another task, resource B is more useful. That's why it's a partial order and not a total order, because those resources are inequivalent. So we have a situation like that in many resource theories, that we don't have a total order, we have a partial order. It's quite often, actually, it's more likely to happen that it's a partial order rather than a total order. So, and then we can use some techniques from mathematics to study this ordering.
And you're saying that these partial orders become more important maybe when you get down to like the mesoscale or something like that, when you're dealing with 10,000 or 100,000 instead of, right. You know, right. 100 quintillion
exactly.
Atoms.
Exactly. So what's happened is the law of large number kicks in when you consider a large number of systems. And what's happened, the law of large numbers, the Shannon entropy or the von Neumann entropy kicks in, and it's kind of like appearing naturally in all the analysis, because when you take many copies of a system, it starts to have a very statistical behavior that determines uniquely by the Shannon entropy or by the von Neumann entropy. And that's how we get the second law of thermodynamics, which really determines an order, not a partial order, like the entropy changes and goes in one direction. The moment you remove this law of large numbers, then you get partial order, because the law of large number is no longer valid in this situation. I must say, though, that even in the many copies case, there are situations where you get a partial order if you allow, for example, a catalysis or thing like that. In those cases, even when you go to the law of large number, you don't always get one function that determines everything. Many times you get more than one. You can get two, or you can get infinitely many, or a finite number. But in any case, it is no longer a total order. The moment you have more than one function, the transitions describe a partial order rather than a total order. But it is a good comment that you mentioned, that it's really when we go to large number, that's where we get total order, typically because of these properties of typical sequences, typicality. The methods of types comes in, the sequences are typical, system statistical mechanics comes in, everything kind of smooth. It smooths away the complexity of the system.
Excellent, excellent. So do you think we're in a position now to understand the role of coherence in thermodynamics?
Yeah, maybe I'll leave it as an open problem to say that, yeah, I mean, we still don't know the full role of coherence in thermodynamics and all the things that it can achieve, that we can achieve with coherence, but we can just see that certain transitions, certain conversions of one resource to another with coherence are possible. So we definitely see that we can do things with coherence that we cannot do without it. But to understand the full extent of what we can do with quantum coherence is an open problem, actually.
Always leave them wanting more, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. So thank you very much. That was great. I think everybody will love this. I think it was really good, and it introduces a lot of concepts that I think a lot of people don't know about, but probably should.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you very much.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 68, Quantum Resource Theories, with Gilad Gur. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/68. Show notes include the paper we read for this podcast, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers. Thank you. Goodbye.